Welcome to Mind, Body, Health, and Politics. I'm your host, Dr. Richard Miller. My guest today is Dr. William Courtney, physician, psychiatrist, and authority on medicinal uses of the cannabinoids. Welcome to Mind, Body, Health, and Politics, Dr. Courtney.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
We've heard in recent programs about psychological effects of marijuana. We've heard about uses and abuses of marijuana. Today, we'd like to hear from you about the medicinal uses of marijuana, with particular reference to the cannabinoids, which do not alter the mind, but which do provide healing benefits. Can you use that as a takeoff to begin telling us about those cannabinoids?
Definitely can. The cannabinoids refer to the 20 and 21 carbon molecules. There were 66 until El Soli published an article this year and found another nine, so we're up to 75 cannabinoids, one of which is psychoactive, the rest of which, in general, have absolutely no psychoactivity.
Let me get you to repeat that. Of all the cannabinoids that have been identified, one is psychoactive. Is that right?
Yeah, one class. The tetrahydrocannabinol is actually a class, and there are some variants that have moderate psychoactivity. But the other classes, cannabigerol, cannabichromine, cannabinol, cannabidiol, those are classes within which there are 5, 6, 7, 8 members, and those are without psychoactivity.
So when people talk on the street and they or in the papers and the media and they use the word marijuana, are they talking about the one that's psychoactive, or are they talking about all of them as a class?
In Humboldt and Mendocino, there are probably several thousand people who are well aware of the non-psychoactive cannabinoids, and they have been pretty diligent at attempting to locate plants that provide increased amounts of the non-psychoactive cannabinoids. But if you talk about United States or the balance of California, then THC has become tantamount with marijuana or cannabis, and most folks, including the government, have kind of identified THC as the sole or single active property, but that clearly is not the case.
It's not the case.
No, I mean, they're the other classes, particularly cannabidiol, cannabigerol, cannabichromine, those have real significant medical benefits. And in part, a lot of their medical benefits come from the fact that they're not psychoactive. The federal government out of Bethesda had initiated some research that led to a patent that's held by the Department of Health and Human Services of the United States, issued in 2003, which was several years before I became involved and interested in cannabinoids. And in that patent, they identified CBD or cannabidiol as being a very important element in the plant, and in large part due to the fact that it's non-psychoactive, allows you to use 100 times more of it than THC. There are some very similarities in the properties between THC and CBD, but a dose, a 10-milligram dose of THC is about all that your average individual can tolerate. A few people with a lot of tolerance may be able to tolerate 20 milligrams, but the dose for THC is, you know, 10 to 20 milligrams, whereas the dose for, say, cannabidiol can be between 1 and 2,000 milligrams. So the non-psychoactives have a increasing role to play as we understand that they can be used in much larger amounts and can be more effective because of that dosing.
Let me clarify something. I'm sure a high percentage of the people listening have either direct experience with marijuana through smoking it or possibly eating it, or certainly they have a family member who has. But for those who have little or no experience, please distinguish for them between psychoactive and what is meant by psychoactive marijuana and non-psychoactive marijuana?
So the psychoactive is going to have a significant amount of THC or tetrahydrocannabinol in it, or THC acid, which with heat you break the acid off, decarboxylates, then it becomes THC. Those concentrations can range from 2 to 28% of the weight is THC. And that's the most familiar, and over the last 10 to 20 years, there's been a lot of hybridization to increase the THC content. And for many individuals, the THC content is tantamount to the medicinal benefit. And a good medicine has a lot of THC, and a weak medicine does not. And that sentiment has, you know, has been directly developed and hybridized to produce plants that would support, you know, that assessment of cannabis. But what has come up recently, and then for individuals out there who can locate O'Shaughnessy's, which is the Journal of Cannabis and Clinical Practice, generally you can find that at the local health food stores. There's a lot of research, particularly in the most recent issue, about high CBD strains, the role of CBD or cannabidiol in cancer, and in general, an interesting thing about that journal is it will stay on top of these rising high CBD strains and where you can locate them and a lot of the benefits that come from that as kind of a indicator of the non-psychoactive cannabinoids that are beginning to surface, you know, in individuals' use as well as in clinical research as well as in basic science research.
Are you saying that O'Shaughnessy's, the Journal of Cannabis and Clinical Practice, helps people locate cannabinoids that affect their body in a healing way but do not alter their consciousness?
Exactly. I mean, the lead article was there's a new lab down in Oakland that tests the cannabis that many dispensaries provide to patients, and they test the cannabis for THC, CBD, and CBN. And when you go into the dispensary to purchase it, it'll tell you what the proportions of those three cannabinoids are in that particular medicine.
Sounds very complicated. I would think it's complicated to the average person. I mean, if someone's listening to this, Dr. Courtney, and they're saying, you know, I could get interested in this marijuana as a medicinal, but I don't want my mind changed. I don't want my mind altered or my consciousness changed. I'd like to take this marijuana the same way that, say, I take penicillin or I take an aspirin, where the medicine has an effect on me, but I don't walk around in a different state of mind. You know, how would they approach this issue?
That probably is my area of specialty, is the non-psychoactive uses, which allow you to use the medicine 24/7. You can use it in the morning, midday, and still function, drive cars. You know, there is no interference with your ability to take care of daily issues.
I'll bet that's quite surprising to a lot of our listeners, and I think it would be surprising to people around the country to hear that there is a whole specialty area that you're in, which is marijuana as a medicinal, which has no altering effect on the consciousness.
You know, I guess I've been so close to the subject that strikes me as new information, but I would have to probably agree to you in general that because of the association between THC, psychoactivity, and quality of the medicine, that what I do on a day-to-day basis probably is quite uncommon.
Oh, I think so. I feel very confident that the tens of millions or more of dollars that are being spent on marijuana are being spent by people who want to alter their consciousness, very similar to those who are spending, you know, this equal amounts or more on alcohol. They're not taking the alcohol because of its effect on the cardiovascular system. They're taking it because of the effect on the mental state, right?
Well, you know, there definitely is a large portion that looks at THC as being, you know, a recreational effect. But the THC also can distract people from pain that cannot be otherwise managed. And so there's a portion of individuals that the THC, is useful for disengaging them from painful situations. Where what's unusual about this new area with doses that are 100 times higher. I mean, a dose for THC is 10 milligrams. For CBD, 1,000 to 2,000 milligrams.
Let me stop you there just for a second, because you've mentioned twice now a dose for THC is 10 milligrams. How would a person who's listening to this, who takes their marijuana, let's say first by smoking it, second by eating it, how would they know how many milligrams they're getting? How would they know if they're smoking it, first of all, how would they know how many milligrams they're getting?
The nice thing about inhaled forms, whether it's vaporized or combusted, is it crosses the pulmonary field and very quickly goes to the central nervous system, and within a very short period of time, the THC has an effect, and individuals titrate their smoking behavior by the strength of the cannabis. So you hear a lot of stuff in the literature, or maybe the courtroom, where they're all excited about the fact that THC is so much more potent today. But the individual, if you have 10 different strains with THC ranging from 5% to 28%, an individual that smokes occasionally, as soon as they take an inhalation, they have a sense of the effect, and they will take shorter, shallower, they'll inhale more ambient air with the smoke to decrease the concentration of a very strong medicine, of a very high THC medicine, or they will take very long deep breaths of a medicine that has less THC in order to achieve the same desired effect. So the individual knows what effect they are comfortable with, and they can reproduce that through smoking behavior and compensate for a very wide range in plant content.
Well, what you're saying then is that each patient or each person who uses the marijuana is regulating their own dose by subjective experience. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Well, doesn't that also mean that if the person gets distracted, for example, and takes a larger puff, or forgets that they just took a puff and takes a second puff, that they could then get themselves into a more saturated state? It's almost as if they popped four pills when they meant to take two or three?
Yeah, and you generally don't do that. I mean, if you use pain pills and one provides enough relief, you rarely take four. That happens more often with eating cannabis.
Let's wait with that and just stay. Okay. We're going to come to it. Thank you very much. But let's stay with the smoking, because this issue of titration and dosage is very important, particularly since we heard from Dr. Phil Wolfson, a psychiatrist, 2 weeks ago, that over-smoking is one of the contributing variables to having a uncomfortable reaction, such as a paranoid reaction to the marijuana rather than a soothing relaxation reaction.
And over-smoking with some of the very high can almost occur with the first inhalation. I mean, some of the medicines are so strong, in which case, if you inhale and it was like produces either palpitations, racing heart, anxiety, you come back to that particular strain and you won't take a real deep, long breath. You'll just take a small breath and you'll bring in ambient air to kind of thin it out. And so each strain, you do have to adjust to, but most folks, grow one type and they know what it is and they know how to deliver an amount that they can use. But
that's for people who grow their own.
Exactly.
But for the customer going out on the street or going to a cannabis club, if they have a license, they might buy one strain that has a certain content at one time and get and adjust to it, as you're saying, but then they might get another strain that has a different percentage of the THC at another time, and so this gets pretty complicated, doesn't it?
Well, it is complicated, but if you're using cannabis regularly, there are just a couple of variables. And the nice thing about if you're going to go to a dispensary and you're looking at maybe at Harborside where you've got 20 or 30 strains, you have quite a selection. If this strain says 28% THC and this one says 7%, you have a rough idea what that means. And if you've smoked one or two, this over here, I'm not going to need as much. This one over here, I may need more, but maybe there's a higher CBD content, and the CBD is an antipsychotic. That's according to El Soli out of the University of Mississippi. He used to, or I mean, still is connected with NIDA. CBD is anxiolytic, which means it lyses or cuts anxiety as opposed to THC. So as you learn, as we get the information about what is in the cannabis, then you can select a medicine that is very stimulating and can produce a lot of acceleration, or you can select a medicine that's sedating, that has CBN as the sedative, and then CBD is the anxiolytic and antipsychotic. And so you can kind of select a medicine, and a good dispensary will help you with, you know, you come in, I'm a novice smoker, they're gonna direct you towards the more mild forms, and they're, you know, they say, you know, start very carefully, just try a little bit, give yourself, you know, a couple hours to make an assessment. No one wants, you know, either a customer or a patient to kind of be made uncomfortable or overwhelmed. And then going back to my clients, a good 30-40% of them really don't want almost any THC effect. They just want to get on with their day. They have work to do. They have an agenda to follow. But they do want relief from inflammation or swelling or pain. And so they're looking for ways that are pretty much totally non-psychoactive, but ones that nonetheless provide them a lot of benefit.
So would it be correct to say then that these patients that you're talking about are looking for lower or almost non-existent THC content, but higher CBD content?
That's a simplified...
I'm trying to simplify it to make it easy for the listeners, exactly, because this is a very complicated area that you're bringing to our attention.
And this paper that just came out by El Soli from the University of Mississippi, the previous assessment had indicated there were like 400 different constituents in cannabis. He's now raised that number to 525. As I mentioned, the cannabinoids were about at 66, and we're now at 75. But the cannabinoids are really just one of the elements that's in cannabis. Other elements that are very important are the terpenes. They have anti-neoplastic, antiviral, antifungal. The flavonoids, which bind directly to the 1A and 2A serotonergic receptors, and have an impact on mood disorders and depression. So, and then not only the separate different elements, which, you know, Western medicine likes to pick out a single molecule, assess it, and but what's unusual about the plant is the synergistic effects of the different constituents and how they work together at lower dosage levels, giving you, you know, probably less side effects, but significant, you know, synergistic effects. And so it is a complex field, but in general, the concept that CBD represents the non-psychoactives, and you can use that in a dose that can be 100 to 150 times that you're using for the THC dose, which, like I said, at a much smaller amount stimulates the CB1 receptor to the maximum amount that you're comfortable with.
Wow, you've certainly made clear why an expert like yourself is someone that people should be consulting with when they're considering and wanting to use this medication. You're listening to Dr. William Courtney being interviewed on the topic of various cannabinoids as medicinals. We're here on Mind, Body, Health, and Politics. I'm your host, Dr. Richard Miller. This is KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willetson, Ukiah, K201 HR 88.1 FM in Fort Bragg. Dr. Courtney, we hear a lot in the media and in the journals about the importance of antioxidants. And there's research on the antioxidant effects being caused or being the result of use of the cannabinoids in a positive way. Can you speak to that topic?
I kind of raised it a little bit earlier.
Yes.
So there's a patent that was issued in 2003 on cannabinoids as antioxidant and neuroprotectants. And this document, if you go to leavesofgrass.info, is one of the PDFs there. It's a 20, 30-page document, and I believe that every person that uses cannabis or is considering it, you should print out a copy and read it several times a day for a couple of weeks.
Really?
It is very, very intense. It explains an antioxidant in ways that are better than anything I've ever read in textbooks, pharmaceutical textbooks. It explains, what oxidation is, what oxidative-associated diseases. It gives you a list of oxidative-associated diseases, which range from cancer and cataracts to head trauma, hemorrhagic or embolic cerebral vascular accidents or strokes, heart disease, autoimmune disorders, rheumatoid, diabetes, gastric ulcer, uveitis, a very extensive list of conditions that an antioxidant can benefit. But what's most unusual about this patent is it gives you a very, very particular dosage schedule. I've, in years of studying this, I've never seen as specific and narrow of a dosage schedule. They mention dosing that could run from 1 to 40, for example, 5 to 20, and the phrase is, and in particular, 20 milligrams per kilogram body weight. And it compares, the patent compares cannabidiol, which is essentially a fat molecule. It's a fatty acid. Oh no! Well, CBDA is fatty acid. CBD, you take the acid off, but it's primarily a fat molecule that has a couple of hydroxyl groups, which allow it to be soluble enough that it can get into the bloodstream. But because of its 20 carbon backbone, it's lipid enough that it can cross the blood-brain barrier. And if you look at the other antioxidants that CBD is compared with in that patent, it compares it to vitamin C, vitamin E. If you look at ascorbic acid, you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You have 6 different oxygen molecules, which makes it a water-soluble vitamin. And a water-soluble constituent will get into the serum, but it's going to have great difficulty crossing membranes and blood-brain barriers because of all that, because of that highly polar nature. And what the patent points out is that CBD is quite unique because it's a fatty or lipid-based antioxidant, which allows it to get into areas where oxidation or the burning of sugars at the mitochondria within the cells to cross the blood-brain barrier, where it can be effective with Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, head trauma. You can read, every time you read this patent, additional information comes from it that is really quite remarkable.
The article, by the way, that Dr. Courtney's talking about is one of many articles that he references on a website called Leaves of Grass. You can find it. Just go to Google and type in Leaves of Grass. The subtitle is Medical Marijuana Information from Dr. William Courtney. When patients come to you and you are going to prescribe non-mind-altering marijuana, what form do they take it in and where do they get it?
Well, we don't actually prescribe cannabis. You can recommend it for someone who's never used it. Possibly 99% of my patient contacts, it's an approval. I'm approving of someone who is already using it but would like to not have to suffer legal consequences from their using it. So, but what they often come for, or a lot of my middle-aged and older patients, is they may have enjoyed THC when they were in their 20s. A lot of them stopped smoking when they were raising their family, and now in their 40s and 50s, football injuries and logging and fishing, and there's articular problems and disc problems, back pain. They're interested in the anti-inflammatory and the analgesic properties, but not the daytime euphoric aspects.
But they want the anti-inflammatory particularly, don't they?
That's probably cannabis. If you're going to look for a single concept, one of its strongest suits is in its ability to provide anti-inflammatory actions. There are 5 or 6 cannabinoids that I know of, and 10 terpenes that are anti-inflammatory. And what no one has assessed is what happens when you mix all of these different ways of altering the inflammatory system? You know, what's the compilation of the synergistic outcome? But in the field, you see that in people that are using the raw green leaf, which the way it comes on the plant, the large shade leaf is not psychoactive. If you get to the smaller leaves near the apical meristem, near the end of the branch, those can be significantly psychoactive. But the very large leaves at the bottom are not psychoactive unless you heat them. In India, they heat them for about 10 minutes, and then grind them up in a mortar and pestle and turn them into little tiny, like half-inch balls of leaf material. One is mild, two is moderate, three is markedly psychoactive. So you can convert the leaf into something that's psychoactive, but my patients are avoiding the heat, which decarboxylates THC acid, releasing the THC. For several years, I was recommending drying the leaf, but when you did that, you ground the dried leaf, you would lose a lot of the terpenes, which have a lot of anti-inflammatory and other properties that are quite beneficial. And so over the years,
terpenes and the flavonoids produce the anti-inflammatory effect?
There are 10 terpenes, I believe, that have distinct terpenes that have anti-inflammatory properties, and 5 to 6 cannabinoids. And this is this is what we know today. You know, it's how much is actually going on in the plant will continue to grow as our studies, provide the information.
Well, let's take a hypothetical case: a 70-year-old man with osteoarthritis, inflammatory condition of bone joints, comes to you. This person does not cultivate marijuana, doesn't smoke marijuana, but has heard this program and wants to use marijuana strictly as an anti-inflammatory and does not want any mind-altering effects. What happens?
Fortunately for people that live in this county, if you don't grow, your neighbor may. And you most likely know someone that does. And if you can trust them, and that's it's a bigger issue than it may seem. A person that is growing either outdoors is less likely to use sprays because you don't have the same environmental conditions that you do indoors. But if you want leaf year-round, and that definitely is something that I would think he would want to consider, if you're going to the indoor grower goes through several phases where there's a lot of those large water leaf or guard leaves that are removed, and composting is a big issue. How do you get rid of all that leaf material?
So this 70-year-old man is now looking for a friend or a neighbor who has an excess or some of these large leaves that they've grown indoors. In other words, this 70-year-old man, this patient, he's not going to your local medical marijuana dispensary, for example. Is that correct? And I need non-psychoactive marijuana that Dr. Courtney said would help my inflammation here.
It's dispensaries are beginning to look at this. I've been talking with enough of them, and I'm working with one up in Humboldt and Arcata right now, who's putting in a very large greenhouse just for the production of leaf. Does juicing, is going to provide juicers, hired a nutritionalist who's keeping track of different conditions and patients, trying to follow its effects. So I hope, in the near future, that dispensaries will look at that as yet another service that their patients could use. But, first they have to come across the information, they've got to test it, try it, get some feedback, and then when they do, then becomes, we need a source of leaf, we need a refrigerator. And so I hope, that it'll be a lot easier in the coming years to go into a dispensary, pick up a bag of leaf like you would spinach, and then take it home and be able to put it in smoothies and pesto and juices.
And know what the content is, because as you said before, with the psychoactive material, 10 milligrams is a sufficient dose, but when it comes to the non-psychoactive medicinals, you could take 100 or even 200 milligrams, but you need to be able to quantify, and somebody needs to quantify so that you can ask for that amount, right, and say, hey, this is what I'd like to take on a daily basis. How many of these little bags should I be purchasing?
Yeah, and actually the dose of the non-psychoactive is not 100 or 200 milligrams. It's 1,000 to 2,000 milligrams.
1,000 to 2,000, so somebody has to be measuring. So we've got science ahead of us. Let me interrupt us to take this phone call, Dr. Courtney.
Okay.
Welcome to Mind, Body, Health, and Politics. You're on the air.
Good morning, doctors.
Good morning.
How are you today?
Quite well, thank you.
This is really informative and fascinating, and I hate to sort of crash the party by bringing up something that is imminently threatening to all of us, which is the vaccination for the so-called swine flu that they are, the WHO is mandating for everybody all over the planet. So I was going to ask Dr. Courtney, will the cannabis do anything to help us either survive the vaccination or organize to stop the vaccination?
Thank you. Very interesting question. Dr. Courtney, what do you think of that?
There are definitely multiple properties in the terpenes and the cannabinoids in the plant that are antibacterial. There's some antiviral. There are definitely some anti-inflammatories. It mimics the body's endogenous cannabinoid system, which is the one of the systems in cellular physiology that regulates cell function in terms of every cell has a particular activity. If it's overactive, the cell wants to downregulate it to a normal function. If it's underactive, it wants to upregulate to keep it in a normal bandwidth. So the body modulates cell function using the endogenous cannabinoids. Cannabis, through its cannabinoids and terpenes, facilitates rapid return to normal function if it gets out of line. So with something like swine flu, first there is going to be the viral infection, and obviously an antiviral would be helpful there. If that's insufficient and you develop a virus, then what often happens is you have a secondary bacterial infection that turns into a pneumonia that is more likely to be the fatal outcome in this situation. So an antibiotic present could help in the very early phases to prevent a condition from becoming even clinical. There was an interesting study out of Icarus in 2000, I think in 2007 in Canada, where it showed that the body stored these fat-soluble messenger molecules, the cannabinoids, as it stores the fat-soluble vitamins A, D, E, and K in the fat tissue because that's where they're comfortable and they're located. But this study showed that the body was able to draw down a specific cannabinoid to meet the demands of a particular situation. If the body had, 77 of these cannabinoids stored in fat tissue, and there were antifungal, antibiotic, anti-neoplastic, if these various functions were stored there and a situation arose and the body could selectively draw them down and use them in the very early stages, way before the situation became clinically detectable, that would be the ideal situation in terms of health maintenance and prevention of illness.
Yeah, suppose somebody hears you talking now and they say, gee whiz, here, I'm hearing that there are endogenous cannabinoids from this doctor. That means cannabinoids that my body produces. Is there anything, and these endogenous cannabinoids that I produce myself actually are anti-inflammatories. Is there anything I can do to increase my own internal production of these endogenous cannabinoids?
The body, one of the nutrients that we eat is arachidonic acid, which is an omega-6 essential fatty acid, meaning that I don't think any mammal can produce arachidonic acid. Arachidonic acid is a simple fatty acid that's stored in the membrane of every cell of the body. And from arachidonic acid, the body synthesizes three broad classes of very important molecules. Synthesizes all of the prostaglandins, synthesizes all of the leukotrienes, which are involved in inflammatory and immune response, and synthesizes all of the endogenous cannabinoids. So Then the next question would be, well, how do I know if I've got enough arachidonic acid,
right.
Well, that's why we have to refer you back to Richard Miller, who understands the practicalities. We know it's an essential fatty acid.
Brings us back to exercise, doesn't it?
Exactly. Exercise is a wonderful place to begin and end.
Well, you heard it, folks. You heard it from Dr. Courtney. It's another commercial for exercise. We're going to take another call here, Dr. Courtney.
Okay.
Welcome to Mind, Body, Health, and Politics. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I would like to ask about the effects of marijuana on ADD in relation to the racing brain syndrome and how I could find information about that.
Great question. Could you hear him, Dr. Courtney?
Yes, I could.
Good.
There's a magazine called Treating Yourself out of Canada, which is of all of the cannabis magazines, it tries to emphasize the medicinal aspects. I mean, there are certainly plenty of pictures of people in bathing suits and the four-color pictures of colas and stuff, but they make an extra effort to reinforce medical properties and kind of educate their readers. And they had a big review on ADHD and ADD. A lot of information there where we don't quite know how it all comes together. I mean, we know that CBD is an anxiolytic. It's also an antipsychotic at one level. And it's also an antidepressant, so it interfaces in probably the serotonergic system. And individuals, particularly that use cannabis for psychiatric issues, can be quite intuitive and are able to state that this strain provides me a lot of benefit and this one makes me really anxious and paranoid and I don't like it at all. I remember having a patient, an adolescent, who had been using trim leaf and found benefit from that, and then when his mother was able to grow enough bud that she could allow her child to use that, she said, you know, here, have the good medicine. And the son said, I don't want the good medicine. I want the leaf. And she said, no, we've been using the leaf because that's all we could afford. But now we can afford the good medicine, which, you know, like I said, is tantamount to high THC. And this individual was, you know, I really don't want the good medicine. I want the bad medicine. And you look at the difference between the leaf and the bud, and one's going to be, you know, going to produce, kind of racing mind palpitations and, you know, anxiogenic, increasing anxiety, whereas the leaf product is going to be anxiolytic and calming, and the individual knew right away that, you know, I don't want that part of the plant. I want this part.
It sounds intimidating to a certain extent, and it sort of reminds me, though, of exactly what's going on with prescription medicine in the SSRIs, which I'm sure you're aware of, namely that many patients have to take, they might take Wellbutrin, and then they might try Effexor, and then they might try Seroquel, and then they might try Paxil, and then they might try Luvox, until they find one that sort of matches, and yet it's an excruciating, a very excruciating protocol and procedure that they go through. And in a way, you're talking about something similar, which says to me, you know, this is the beginning of a new era. It's the beginning of a new era with regard to understanding the cannabinoids and how they can be used medicinally, just like it's the beginning of a new era with regard to what we call prescription medicine, antidepressants. And those of us who are in this kind of beginning transitionary stage we're going to pay a price. There's going to be a lot of inconvenience, if not worse. It's sort of like, you know, where the car was better than the horse, but a lot of cars broke down for many years until we got them pretty well reliable. It's a complicated situation. Let me take another call here, please.
Okay, but one point on that, if you go to that Leaves of Grass. The first two documents are the International Cannabinoid Research Society abstracts, each about 140 papers. Very informative as to the basic science going on. And if you look at who's sponsoring the research, it's Merck, Abbott Labs, Bristol-Myers Squibb. So the major global pharmaceuticals are moving in,
yes,
and funding the research and knowing that this really is a low side effect solution to a lot of the problems that they currently are dealing with, medicines that, you know, have as much of a side effect as a primary effect.
Yeah, there's no question marijuana is moving into the mainstream around the country. Do we have the person on the air?
Yes,
welcome
I'm
to
here.
Mind Body Health. You're on the air.
Greetings, doctors. Thank you for your good work, Dr. Courtney.
Thank you.
Could you please briefly discuss this debate between indoor and outdoor and why the legalization, the pot clubs are pushing the indoor when most of us know that the true way to grow this plant organically is outdoor, and it's very difficult to not use chemicals indoor, and they don't understand using a chemical pot for sick people. Thank you.
Dr. Courtney, if you will, you know, we've got 2 minutes left, and I don't want to get into the politics of indoor and outdoor unless you want to comment on how each of them affects the medicinal use of the non-psychoactive cannabinoids.
Yeah, we really haven't had a chance to really talk about juicing.
No.
And that is something that is really dear to my heart in terms of, but it, the nice thing about indoor is it allows us access to leaf on a year-round basis as long as they're not using chemicals. I think, you know, I've talked with someone down in Salinas who is interested in producing plants and putting it in plastic bags and, you know, making it available widely. Obviously, I would prefer an outdoor plant, but around in the northern environment, it's hard to have fresh green leaf on a year-round basis without going indoors. We're trying to develop some techniques that are low wattage, which would use LEDs and it would rapidly cycle, so that you essentially would be bringing plants through every 2 weeks, which would allow a large production of leaf. And then if you move into the high CBD plants, you would actually be producing bud that you could make kief from, and that kief could be used topically. Topical kief is excellent for arthritis. We didn't quite get back to that, but you can get a very high local effect, and you can even use the THC without becoming psychoactive for particular joints and fingers. And so there's the topical use of the bud is useful. The bud could also be used in yogurt at bedtime for sleep without the psychoactivity interfering with your daytime activities. And then the raw green leaf is really, I think, will become a dietary essential. I mean, it's a leafy green vegetable that for 34 million years has been evolving and has developed a very strong niche of helping the body's immune system function more effectively by relying on the exact same mechanisms. I mean, there are terpenes that bind at allosteric or secondary sites that alter the binding affinity of the receptor for the primary cannabinoid, like CBD. So you have multiple molecules impacting the receptors in the immune system. I mean, this is such an interwoven system.
And a complicated system. We've got, you know, just 30 seconds. I want to ask one last question in 30 seconds, please. And that is, when people go to a medical marijuana dispensary, can they find out the content of what they're eating when they get a cookie or a brownie or a drink? Can they find out the content yet, or is that something we have to do in the future?
It's coming along.
It's coming along.
This fellow down in Gualala, all of his ingredients are there, and he's trying to get Steep Hill, which is the analytic lab, to assess the THC, CBD, and CBN. And so you'd be able to pick up this cookie and you go,
I know what the quantification is.
And that it's consistent,
yeah.
You know, that every cookie is going to have the same amount rather than kind of homemade and,
yes,
and varying widely.
Dr. Courtney, I want to thank you. It's been extremely informative. I think the takeaway for today is that there's a tremendous difference between lighting up, having a smoke to alter one's consciousness for recreational use, and using marijuana as a medicinal, where you go to a doctor like Dr. Courtney and you get very specific recommendations, and then he's got to help you actually find the medicine because you can't buy it in your local store.